5 for 3 hours of the best in ska, rocksteady, roots and culture, dub and dancehall, from the foundational Jamaican recordings to the latest international releases. That's Reggae Central, 2 to 5 p.m. every Sunday, right here on KPFK.
This is Quetzal Flores from the band Quetzal, and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 Los Angeles.
Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman. At the end of September, political theorist Ilya Matveyev joined the Critique Editorial Board, of which I am a member, to present his ideas about imperialism in the 21st century. I moderated that enlightening discussion and am now bringing it to you. Matveyev examines the emerging era of inter-imperialist rivalry and asks, what's really driving the strategies of Russia, China, and the United States? China has risen as a manufacturing superpower with national capital tightly fused to the party state. Russia, in a neo-fascist turn, has shattered the global free trade order with its invasion of Ukraine. The United States, still unmatched in military and financial power, confronts both as rivals, even as Trump's second administration dismantles the alliances and institutions that once underpinned American primacy. What theories of imperialism can help us make sense of this fractured world order? Matveyev argues that to grasp today's disjointed global system, we must reckon not only with the structural contradictions of capitalism, but also with the sovereign decisions and ideological projects of political elites. We'll bring you this discussion when our program returns in just a moment. Really a pleasure to have Ilya Matveyev with us today. His paper, which is going to be published in Spectre Journal, I think, very soon, a journal that Bob and I actually were in the founding of but got kicked out of. and it builds on the earlier conversation that we had with Ilya Budryatskis, who is – it's possible that Ilya will be joining us. He's not quite sure. And it draws from their forthcoming book, Russia's New Imperialism, Capital and Ideology. And in this paper, Ilya examines the emerging era of inter-imperialist rivalry and asks what is really driving the strategies of Russia, China, and the United States. China has risen as a manufacturing superpower with national capital tightly fused to the party state. Russia, in what they call a neo-fascist turn, has shattered the global free trade order with its invasion of Ukraine. The U.S. is still unmatched in military and financial power, but it confronts both as rivals, even as Trump's second administration dismantles the alliances and institutions that once underpinned American primacy. So what theories of imperialism can help us understand this fractured order? That's what Ilya is going to try to help us understand in looking at the disjointed world that we have, that we need to reckon with, not only looking at the structural contradictions of capitalism, but also with the sovereign decisions and ideological projects of political elites. But let me properly introduce Ilya to all of you. He's a Russian political economist, dissident scholar, a member of the Public Sociology Laboratory. That's a collective of engaged researchers studying post-Soviet politics and society. He taught for many years at St. Petersburg before being forced into exile after Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. He was designated a foreign agent by the Russian government, and he has since, along with Ilya Budryatskis, held a two-year Scholars at Risk fellowship at UC Berkeley, which ended, sadly, in February 2025. Matveyev's work bridges political economy and ideology, examining capitalism, authoritarianism, and imperialism in Russia and beyond. And I already mentioned this forthcoming book, co-authored with Ilya Budryatskis, and they both just got it accepted at Stanford University Press, so woohoo, that's great, called Russia's New Imperialism, Capital and Ideology. And that analyzes the economic and ideological foundations of Russia's aggressive turn to war. Ilya writes widely. You can Google him and find him almost everywhere, both academic and popular outlets. And we're going to hope that he also writes for Critique. So with all of that, Ilya, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And thank you for introducing me and for inviting me. I'm really happy to be able to present my work. I should say that this article is not really part of the book. So it kind of develops these ideas, but the book is about Russia. The book is 95% about Russia, and the article is about China, the United States, and I just wanted to understand, to get the broader picture, what's going on, not just with Russia, but with kind of global geopolitical situation, geoeconomic situation in general. So that was the idea for this paper. And also, I should say that I'm now in Belgrade, in Serbia. I'm not sure when I'm coming back to the United States, even if I manage to get a visa. You know, it's a bit difficult now. But Ilya Budraitskis is at Berkeley, so he's now a graduate student. Yeah, so he's like totally available to hang out in person as well, you know, unlike me, unfortunately. So I prepared a little presentation, basically. Wow. Yeah, it's just based on the article. So I will start with this news story from New York Times. So China completely dominates automation right now and has more industrial robots than the rest of the world combined, right? And actually installs more industrial robots every year than the rest of the world combined, including even countries like Japan. So Japan was previously the leader in industrial robotics, but now China is this unstoppable powerhouse in everything related to manufacturing. And the starting point of my article is that we have such a strange asymmetry and imbalance in the world because China completely dominates manufacturing. And I think the scale of this domination, we do not fully appreciate it yet, but China is really, really dominant. So if we look at the share of global industrial production, you see this dramatic rise of China, and now China controls more than a third of global manufacturing. So more than a third of all global industry is located in one country. And Chinese industry is now bigger than industrial production of top 10 competitors combined, right? So it's much, much bigger than the United States and basically the rest of the world. And the growth of industrial production and even the growth of industrial share of China is continuing. So China is actually producing more, exporting more, and China is not stopping, right? So at some point, China can control like half of all world manufacturing, which is crazy. So if we look at specific industries, we see an even stronger dominance. Like for instance, if we look at solar panels and the production of solar energy, which is the most important industry for mitigating climate change, China completely dominates the whole supply chain of solar panels. It's basically a monopoly. So no one is even close to China. And solar is the most important industry in terms of even having the chance to prevent the worst effects of climate change. So the world needs to switch to electricity. And in order to do that, the most powerful instrument is to install new solar power. So wind power is important, but solar power is even more important. And China is basically, you know, it's not even dominating. It's a monopolist in solar panels. And so the story about climate change, to a large extent, it's a story about China right now. So China, this chart is from 2021. So what we see now is that China dominates demand. So more than 60% of all renewable capacity, it all goes to China. And also China completely dominates the supply, right? So China is the country which is actively fighting climate change at the moment, while the United States, Trump just denies the existence of climate change. So it's also a very strange kind of imbalance that we see right now. But at the same time, it's not like China is completely dominant in everything else. The fact is that in terms of military power, the United States is still an absolutely dominant country, and China is not even close to the United States in terms of sheer military might. Like, we can look at the military budget, which is still much bigger in the United States than in China. And also, in relative terms, America spends more than 4% of the GDP on military, and China spends less than 2% of the GDP. So China still does not prioritize military to the extent that the United States prioritizes military spending. So America really spends much more on military production. And then you can see some key indicators, like, for instance, the domination of air. So this is basically the most important aspect of conventional warfare. And the United States completely dominates with fighter jets, with the most advanced airplanes, and so on. Also, the United States completely dominates China in terms of aircraft carriers, helicopter carriers. So in terms of, you know, hard power, in terms of military power, the United States is still much, much stronger than China. And in fact, it's not even clear whether China can narrow this gap. So it seems that it might actually be impossible. The United States can be basically unstoppable as a military power. And China is not even trying very actively to do that, because they still do not prioritize military spending to an extent that the United States prioritizes military spending. And then we can look at the global role of the dollar. Again, we see complete domination of the United States. So in terms of finance, China is basically not even noticeable. So yuan is not even noticeable in global trade, in global currency reserves. It's super important to Russia. That's the only country in the world, basically, where, you know, yuan is more important than dollar, because Russia completely de-dollarized. Now, Russia basically doesn't use dollars at all, because it has no access to the dollar financial system. But the rest of the world, so this chart combines, it's a kind of, I didn't include the title, but it's a combination of different things. It's a combination of currency reserves, trading, export invoicing. So once you combine all these indicators, you get this index, and dollar is completely dominant in all of these fields, right? And in fact, we don't really see that its role is eroding somehow. It is still dominant, and it is going nowhere in terms of financial dominance. And so we have this weird asymmetry in which China completely dominates manufacturing, but the United States completely dominates military and finance, right? So two sides of the same coin, or two sides to this whole issue. And then we can look at tech companies, and again we see the dominance of the United States. In fact, in terms of revenue, the top 10 high tech companies in the world, only two companies are from China, and six companies are from the United States, right? So still in the tech sector, America has the edge. America has the lead. In terms of sheer volume of production, China overpowers America. But in terms of innovation, maybe understood quite narrowly as tech innovation, artificial intelligence, and so on, still America is much stronger than China. And so on the one hand, we have two very powerful countries. On the other hand, their power is very uneven. So China has one dimension of power, and the United States has another dimension of power. And then the question is, how do we understand this asymmetry? How do we understand this imbalance? So how do we even understand major non-Western powers in general? So what are the Marxist or the critical tools to understand the role of countries like China or Russia? There are several theories that are, you know, quite popular in left-wing analysis. So one theory is the theory of the transnational capitalist class. And the idea here is that it doesn't even matter that China dominates manufacturing and America dominates finance, let's say, because capital is no longer connected to any particular country. So capital is truly global or transnational. And therefore, China becomes a kind of manufacturing platform for transnational capital. And the United States is a financial center, a consumer market. But the important point is that it's like a division of labor. It's not important geopolitically because nation states are no longer important geopolitically, according to this theory, right? Because we have this transnational capitalist class. It is consolidated, it is unified, and we also have this emerging transnational state, supposedly, which kind of overcomes national barriers, and nation states, they gradually join together and form this single transnational state. So this is one theory. I mean, it is developed by William Robinson, most in his many books. So, but then if we look at empirical reality, we see that this theory doesn't really work that well because we see this geopolitical competition. Geopolitical competition is real. And we see trade restrictions, military tensions, all kinds of conflicts emerging between the United States and China, let's say. And from this perspective, how can we even talk about the emergence of the transnational state if we see real geopolitical conflict between states, right? So this theory doesn't really work. Even though it works well to explain the globalization of production, the globalization of supply chains, but it doesn't really work in explaining geopolitical conflicts, geopolitical tensions. So the second theory is the theory of subimperialism developed at the moment, developed most notably by Patrick Bond. So this theory is rooted in Latin American dependency theories. Now, like Patrick develops this theory to explain BRICS countries. So his main kind of his thing, right, is talking about BRICS. And his point is that there is a hierarchy of countries, let's say. You have the imperialist core, you have the West, and then you have sub-imperialist countries that are geopolitically and economically dependent on the West. So it's not a transnational state. Nation states, they still exist. But BRICS countries and non-Western, major non-Western countries in general, they are dependent on the West. And they cooperate with Western powers. And in fact, they have a kind of subordinate role in this relationship, right? Again, this theory explains a lot, but it doesn't really explain the conflict between China and the United States, because clearly China is not subordinate to the United States in terms of geopolitics. We cannot say that, you know, America has this ultimate power over China, or that America has the ultimate power over Russia. If America had the ultimate power over Russia, then Russia wouldn't attack Ukraine, define the United States, define Europe, define the West. So clearly, China and Russia, they have much more autonomy that this theory of sub-imperialism allows for. And so, again, we have some empirical difficulties. So we have this theory. It works to some extent to explain, let's say, financial institutions of the BRICS countries, like New Development Bank. So it was created as a kind of substitute for World Bank. But in reality, it's very similar in how it works. And also World Bank economists, they work now in this New Development Bank. And this New Development Bank, it also gives loans in dollars, right? So the currency is dollar. And so it's fully dependent on the financial system, which is controlled by the United States. And so this New Development Bank, even though it's a BRICS institution, and Russia was one of the founders of this New Development Bank, now it does not work in Russia at all, because it's basically controlled by a U.S. Treasury, you know, in an indirect way. And so in that sense, Patrick's theory of sub-imperialism works to some extent. Really, some multilateral institutions of the BRICS countries, they look like they are subordinate institutions to the West. But at the same time, these countries themselves, we can no longer say that they are fully subordinate to the West, that they occupy this subordinate second level position in the global system. So I would say that for Russia and for China, this is simply not true. Maybe for India, for Brazil, for South Africa, we can still argue that they are sub-imperialist in Patrick's sense. I mean, Russia and China, they're clearly not sub-imperialist. So they do not fit the criteria of sub-imperialism. Finally, we have this theory of heartland and contender states. It was developed by Kees van der Peel and developed by people like Radhika Desai. So this is a bit kind of campist interpretation of the world. And the main point is that countries like Russia and China, they do have autonomy. So they are not subordinate to the West. But the main point is they defend themselves from Western imperialism. So according to this theory, there is only one imperialism in the world. It's Western imperialism. And so-called contender states, they defend themselves from America, from Western capital, from the encroachment of Western capital. And I mean, they're autonomous, but they cannot be imperialist themselves by definition, right? And so, again, this theory, it fails in terms of empirical verification, because now we have Russia, which is clearly an imperialist power. I mean, it is engaged in imperialist aggression against Ukraine. And so it is the aggressor. It is not defending itself from anyone. It is an aggressive power, right? So how do we explain Russia's actions as a defense from Western encroachment? It doesn't make sense. So we can go into detail on this point, but the short version is it doesn't make sense. Russia is, you know, a full-on imperialist, very much comparable to the United States, and China actually as well, but probably less than Russia at this point. So we have all these theories, and they do not fully work. This is the first point of my article, that we need something new. At least we need some kind of combination of these theories, maybe, in order to explain what's going on in the world. So then I talk about Russia and China specifically, and I begin with China. So what is the story with China? What is the basis of this structural conflict between China and the United States? On the one hand, we know that in the 90s and the 2000s, China was the solution to the crisis of overaccumulation in the West. So this is a point made by many, many people. And China had this huge reserve of labor, and this labor force entered the global market. And because of that, corporate profits of Western-based corporations, they increased dramatically because they moved production to China, and it was much cheaper to produce goods there. And so corporate profits went up. You can see from this chart that beginning in the 90s, corporate profits began to move upwards because of reintegration of China into the global market. And there is research that demonstrates specifically that China was one biggest factor of increasing American corporate profits. So China specifically is the most important factor in this. And also China reinvested its own export revenues into American public debt. And it was a kind of a circle. So American companies use China to produce goods, and then this trade surplus is reinvested in American debt. And this whole thing was called Chimerica by mainstream economists. So Chimerica, because their point was that this economic relationship between America and China, it was closer to like a single country than an international relationship. It was closer to like a national economy, because Chinese and American economy were so dependent on each other, right? They were part of a single economic complex that involved trade flows, financial flows, everything. However, what happened next was the rise of Chinese capital, China's own corporations. So during, you know, the years of Chimerica, actually, most of Chinese production was controlled directly by Western capital. So we have the statistics from Chinese statistical office. They call these companies foreign invested enterprises. So companies with some foreign stake. And these companies have risen dramatically since the 80s. And at the peak, 60% of all Chinese imports and exports, they were controlled by foreign capital, essentially, right? So foreign capital organized production in China directly. But what we see then is that the share has declined since the mid-2000s, right? And China's own companies have risen, and they actually challenged American companies. And for some time, China had more corporations on the Fortune Global 500 list than the United States. So China began to dominate the corporate world, Chinese own capital. And Chinese capital has this characteristic that it is not just dependent on the state, but it is actually merged with the state. So it's very difficult to distinguish between state and capital in the Chinese case, because most of these corporations, they're actually state owned, and the heads of these corporations, they are nominated through nomenklatura system, like in the Soviet Union, you know. So regional party committees, like national party committees, they nominate the heads of state corporations. But they're also sent to get their MBAs from the United States. And so it's a weird combination of nomenklatura and Western business education, you know. Like when I was reading up for this article, I read a lot about Chinese capitalist class. And really, they're extremely educated. Like half of these people, half of the Chinese corporate elite, they went to the United States to get a business education. At the same time, they have party training in China. They have like party schools, they have everything. They have, and they're also nominated through nomenklatura. So like in the Soviet system, you know, Obkom, so Centralny Komitet, Central Committee of the Communist Party, they nominate these corporate leaders, and then they send them to get Western business education, right? So Chinese business class has kind of two faces. One face looks towards the West, looks towards the global economy. Another face looks towards the Chinese state. And the state dominates in these relationships. So Chinese capital is not the agent of the global economy within China. In fact, Chinese capital is the agent of the Chinese state in the global economy, right? So Chinese state takes the lead, the party state leadership directs the goals of these Chinese corporations, and even private corporations, like 500 biggest private companies in China, all have Communist Party cells in them. That was like a special campaign by Xi Jinping. And his goal was to create these party cells in all of the biggest corporations, essentially, in order to be able to control them and to steer them in the direction that he needs. And, you know, the party cell acts as a kind of second leadership for the private company. And so, you know, private capital does have its own CEOs and boards of directors, but it also has the party control. And so the party can control both, you know, state capital and private capital. So Chinese corporations are essentially an extension of the Chinese state. And at the same time, they're so powerful. As you can see, they rival Western corporations and they rival American corporations. They far outpaced European corporations in terms of size, and they rival American corporations in terms of size, in terms of revenue, in terms of profits and everything. So we have this combination of American capital, which is kind of liberal in the sense that it is not merged with the American state. It's separate from the state structures, from the state elites. And we also have Chinese capital, which is merged with the state, which is different in terms of its nature, in terms of its essence. And we have this competition between American and Western kind of liberal capital and Chinese party state capital. So this is the fundamental factor in this conflict between China and the United States. But an important factor is that China itself suffers from an overaccumulation crisis. So in terms of the development of global capitalism, at first, China was the solution to the crisis of overaccumulation. And now China itself has the problem of overaccumulation, right? So this was analyzed by David Harvey, let's say, many books and articles. And he applied his concept of spatial fix to China. So the logic is that China needs to invest its surplus capital around the world, and China needs the export of capital in order to overcome this crisis of accumulation, overaccumulation. So all these so-called ghost cities, you know, empty spaces where China for some reason built these urban structures and then almost no one lives there. The reason for this is the crisis of overaccumulation. So they try to find the outlet for this excess capital, and they really can't do this. And so this investment is basically lost. And now China has huge economic crisis because of that, because they cannot find a profitable outlet for surplus capital and also a profitable outlet for their overcapacity of industrial production. So most economic sectors in China, they suffer from overcapacity, right? And so they need some other country, some other export markets. And America closes off its market from China, and European countries also try to close their markets off from China. And so China, you know, it creates even more problems for China, but they still subsidize their industrial production because they want to maintain their growth model. And this creates this crazy situation where China just basically looks around the world for an export market, you know, for a place to sell their goods, to dump their goods. And in that sense, by the way, Russia's war against Ukraine was a real boon to China because they have overcapacity, and suddenly Russia becomes this huge, ripe consumer market for Chinese goods because the West no longer sells anything to Russia, and so China steps in and basically sells everything to Russia, and things like cars, like practically the only cars being sold in Russia are Chinese cars at the moment. So Russia is this gigantic market for Chinese cars. Yeah. So what can we say about this rivalry between China and the United States based on my analysis? On the one hand, we have this conflict between, like I said, this liberal capital coming from the United States and Chinese party state capital. On the other hand, we also have interdependence, because we still have these structures of chimerica. They're still in place to some extent because American companies still produce consumer goods in China. They still acquire consumer goods in China and then they sell them in America, right? And China still has a huge chunk of American public debt. So this old system of chimerica, it's not complete, it hasn't completely disappeared. It's still in place. But it is gradually being kind of superseded by this new period of conflict, right? So we still have interdependence, but we also have conflict. And there are these structural reasons for interdependence, but there are also deep structural reasons for this conflict between the United States and China. And so it's a combination of interdependence and conflicts. And the big question is, we understand how this works from the economic point of view, from the point of view of capitalist contradictions, but how will this translate into geopolitics? What does it mean for geopolitics? What does it mean for the geopolitical conflict between the United States and China, right? On the one hand, we have this kind of push for conflict and for competition coming from the contradictions of capitalism. So capitalism, you know, forces these two countries to compete, because they have two national capitals that are in competition with each other. On the other hand, in terms of geopolitical competition, in fact, the United States is still much stronger than China because of its military power, because of its financial power. And what does this mean? Does it mean that China will gradually develop, try to develop a very strong military to compete with the United States? Does it mean that China will try to build military bases all around the world because now there is this gigantic asymmetry that, like, America has 750 military bases in different countries, and China has maybe a couple dozen, you know, comparable to American bases. So in terms of global military presence, it's not even close. It's not even close. The United States is extremely powerful in terms of its military, but China is extremely powerful in terms of production, right? So if these two countries are really rivals and competitors right now, what does it mean for geopolitical competition? It's still not clear. And finally, there is structure and agency, right? I described structural factors, but we also have the agency of particular leaders like Donald Trump. So we can talk all we want about structure, about capitalist contradictions, but Trump has his own agency and he can, you know, he can change things just because he wants to. So you cannot reduce this to structural factors. We have to account for the agency of particular national leaders. So, I mean, especially in case of Putin, we need to account for agency, because in the Russian case, the structural factors are much weaker than in the Chinese case, for instance. But we also have Xi Jinping, right? So what should we expect from Xi? It's also not clear. And so this whole thing is complicated by the fact that we need to account for the agency of national leaders, of national political systems, and we cannot reduce it to structural economic factors. And so the final point about Russia. As you can see, Russia's overall economic role is negligible. We cannot even talk about Russia in the same league as China and the United States. Like, you can look at this chart, the number of companies on the Fortune Global 500 list. So Russia is basically non-existent on this list. Russian capital is extremely weak. I mean, it's much weaker than European capital and much, much weaker than American capital and Chinese capital. So Russia's economic role is, I mean, Russia can, like, if we look at the economic situation, Russia can be integrated into any kind of economic order. It can be integrated into a kind of globalized capitalism dominated by the United States. It's not a problem, because unlike Chinese capital, Russian capital is not a threat to the United States because it's so weak, because it's so small. So Russian can be integrated into the Chinese economic order and become a kind of appendage to China in terms of the economy. So, like I said, in terms of capitalism, in terms of national capital, Russia's role is minuscule. It's very small. At the same time, Russia does control some key natural resources, and Russia controls about 10% of the global oil trade. And this turned out to be pretty significant, because you cannot exclude Russia from the global oil trade. This is what we discovered since 2022. So we cannot simply, like, I mean, America can try and ban Russia from selling oil. And maybe there will be some success in this complete ban on selling Russian oil, but this will create a huge, huge upheaval on the global oil market, on the global energy market. So 10% share of global oil trade is very significant in terms of the potential to wreak havoc in this whole kind of oil trade situation. So this is one thing. Another thing is the nuclear arsenal. I mean, Russia still owns the largest number of nuclear warheads in the world. At present, Russia has the biggest nuclear arsenal in the world, bigger than the United States. This creates its own kind of game, its own balance. So from the point of view of the economy, Russia is, you know, you cannot even notice it when you look at America and China. But from the point of view of nuclear arsenal, Russia is extremely significant. And so this is very important for China. You can see that China has much, like, fewer nuclear warheads than Russia. And so Russia and China complement each other, because China has this industrial might, Russia has nuclear might, also Russia has natural resources and agricultural production. Also, one of those things in which Russia is very proficient is apparently agricultural exports. In recent years, Russia became the biggest exporter of grain in the world, right? So Russia exports about 20-25% of the world's grain. So this number is actually a bit misleading because grain exports are only 1% of grain consumption. So most of the grain is actually produced by the countries themselves. Like most countries, they feed themselves. But those countries that cannot fully feed themselves, Russia is super important to them. And so like Russian economy is very small in terms of pure numbers, but Russia controls some of those choke points in the global economic system. So it controls oil, it controls fertilizer. Fertilizer is super important for agricultural systems. It also controls grain, and it controls nuclear warheads and nuclear reactors, by the way, through Rosatom. So a very important industry, and Rosatom is the global leader in building nuclear reactors. So Russia has these very specific strengths that somehow play out in this conflict. But the important point is that we cannot explain this conflict between Russia and the West, Russia and the United States, through structural factors. Like, this is my strong kind of thesis in this article and actually in our book with Ilya. There are no real structural factors that can explain Russia's confrontation with the West. In terms of capitalist contradictions, in terms of the geopolitical situation, there was nothing that would create this strong pressure to have this conflict. And I can very easily imagine a different Russia, which is not in conflict with the West. And in fact, we already can see this, you know, emerging. So Trump is in power in the United States. And again, we can see an alliance between Russia and the United States. I mean, we can see conflict, we can imagine an alliance between these two countries, because there are no real structural factors that would pull these two countries apart, unlike China and the United States. So with China, it's a different story. It's a real structural kind of confrontation because it's based on capitalist contradictions. But with Russia, it's different. It's mostly based on our leadership, Russian leadership, and its crazy ideas about everything. So it's rooted in ideology. It's not a very Marxist explanation, but this is what we kind of came up with when we did research for this book and when we were writing the book. That was inescapable for us. This conclusion was inescapable, that it's not about structural factors. It's about agency of Russian political leadership and Vladimir Putin specifically, right? So the bottom line is, we definitely live in this period of inter-imperialist rivalry, but this rivalry it is uneven in terms of structural factors and agency-related factors. It is uneven in terms of strengths of different countries, and it creates this very complex picture in which we still have interdependence, but we also have rivalry, and we still do not fully understand how this thing will play out, because it can go in, you know, different ways and different directions based on this analysis. So this is my paper in a nutshell. Thank you so much.
That was great. Thank you. Super interesting. I'm just going to ask one question about the U.S. in the end, because you started to compare Putin to Trump in that these are, let's call it, erratic personalities, and their agency makes a huge difference in the world. So in terms of, you know, in your paper, you do talk a bit about this. So how do you see it with the United States? Is there any structural reason that can explain what Trump is doing, or it is, again, just his personality?
So I was, of course, thinking about this a lot. And there is a structural reason for this gradual delinking between China and the United States. So their economies, there should be some kind of divergence between these two economies. And we could expect some kind of protectionist measures and, you know, the rise of protectionism because of this structural competition between American and Chinese capital, right? So if Chinese capital relies on the state, then American capital also needs to rely on the state. That's the logic here, right? So we cannot imagine a situation where Chinese capital has the full power of the Chinese state behind it, and then American capital just relies on its own strengths and kind of disengages from American state. So we, like, from a Marxist standpoint, we could expect some kind of merging of state and economic power in America as well, because of just because of this competition with China. But then again, like Trump's tariff strategy, it was all him. It wasn't a deep structural thing. It was just all him, because some elements of this strategy, they were already present in Biden. So, I mean, like Trump introduced a lot of tariffs against China during his first term, and then Biden, you know, maintained most of these tariffs and introduced a few tariffs of his own. Like, for instance, Biden introduced 100% tariff on Chinese electric vehicles. So it was Biden, it was not Trump, right? So some elements of protectionism, they clearly have some kind of deep structural roots. But this idea of a trade war against everyone, so this is just Trump's concept of, you know, the economy, the world. This is an ideological thing, because this is his understanding of the global economy. Like, I see it this way, that this is how he understands the global economy, and it's his very deep belief and conviction that tariffs can, you know, help with everything. So they're a solution to everything. And also they don't have a downside. So we can introduce as many tariffs as we want, and this will only bring benefits. So this is Trump's kind of idea about tariffs. So this cannot be reduced to any kind of structural explanation. This is just, you know, Trump's ideology. And what is important to understand here is that it's not a fluke. It's his real conviction, because he began talking about this in the 80s. So he has his whole kind of, you know, system of ideas. So there is some logic to this kind of madness, you know. So, but it's still, this is like an ideological thing. It's not a structural thing. It's an ideological thing. So it's a bit the same with Putin. So there are some like structural reasons for, I don't know, like for Russia's active role in the post-Soviet space. In the first like chapters of our book, we talk about Russian capital and its regional expansion. So there is definitely like a structural reason for Russia to be very assertive, very active in the post-Soviet space, in the former Soviet countries. But there is no reason for Russia to attack Ukraine. There is no real structural reason for Russia to attack Ukraine and to launch a full-scale like invasion of Ukraine. This is just Putin's understanding of Ukraine, of the West, of the world. So it's all rooted in a very specific ideology. And in that sense, he is comparable to Trump. So one good thing about Trump is that his ideology is not extremely militaristic. So even though he started a few wars, you know, still he, like, his convictions, they do not relate to the use of force. It's mostly about trade, it's about tariffs. But with Putin, it's different. He strongly believes in military aggression. For him, this is like the way forward. He, like, Putin understands military force in the same way as Trump understands tariffs, as a way to solve all problems. If we put enough military force, if we put enough kind of military pressure, then you can solve any problem you want. Like, you have this problem with the West, you can solve it through war, through military aggression. So in that sense, they're kind of similar.
So Bob Arnott?
Yeah, I just want to kind of object really to something that Yasmin said about the relatively more benign nature of Chinese imperialism, colonialism than past forms. I take my example from Kano in northern Nigeria, where the whole manufacturing sector, very scant manufacturing sector as it was, has now been totally dominated by Chinese companies. It's hard to believe that wages have actually been compressed by the Chinese manufacturing companies, because the wages are already fantastically low, but there have been. labor discipline in the Kano plants is extremely vicious. I mean, there's no other word to describe it. I think also this question of Chinese loans needs to be qualified. In northern Nigeria, what China has done is it's taken land as the guarantor for the loans that have been given. And remember, the loans operate at all sorts of levels. It's not just at the national state level. They also operate at local state levels. So China, for example, in the northern state of Jigawa, built an airport that was completely useless. It's a beautiful airport, but it was completely useless to the people of Jigawa state. But in return for this, they have taken over vast tracts of land in northern Nigeria, in Jigawa state. The other thing that's been done is that they've actually seized, as a consequence of debt repayment failures, significant assets. So I think, I may be wrong on this, but I think this is the case. I think that the Chinese have actually taken over the major port in Dar es Salaam as a consequence of debt failure on the part of the Tanzanian government. So I think we need to be careful that we don't fall into the trap of identifying this as some benign process. In many ways, it's just as rapacious. It's slightly more hidden, perhaps, but it's just as rapacious as colonialism in the past.
So I will comment on the Russian economy, right? So just like update your ideas about what's going on in Russia just very quickly. So like generally speaking, Russia's economic organization is close to Chinese economic organization. So this is state capitalism, and Russian economic elites, they're also kind of merged with the state, but without the Communist Party as an organization that controls everything. So instead, we have kind of informal networks around Putin and managers of state corporations. They belong to Putin's entourage, Putin's inner circle, and Putin controls the economy through these informal connections, but also through the government itself. So state corporations, they cooperate with government structures, and it's an example of state capitalism. And Russian economy, it's small, but it proved to be very resilient. And in fact, Russian like government is very capable at the moment. So this is important to understand. It might not be the most important thing like globally, but it's just the fact that Russian government is very capable. It is kind of technocratic. So there is an economic technocracy, and Putin respects technocratic management. So according to Putin, this is very important that you nominate capable people, and he tries to choose capable economists in some key positions, like the central bank and even the army itself. So the current Minister of Defense, and by the way, in Russia it's called Ministry of Defense, in America it's now called Ministry of War. Imagine that. In Russia, it's still the Ministry of Defense. So the current Minister of Defense, he is an economist, Andrei Belousov. He is a heterodox economist, actually with economic training and even some publications. And he is maybe the leader of this state capitalist kind of economic school within the government. And so his nomination as the Minister of Defense was not an accident. That was deliberate, because Putin kind of wants to run the military as a technocracy. So he wants the military to be effective. He wants the money to be well spent. And so, in general, Russian economy is state capitalism, very tightly controlled by the Kremlin, with a huge technocratic component, with very capable managers in the state sector, in private companies. So Russian corporations, they're also like very capable, very resilient. And because of that, Russia manages to soldier on in this extremely difficult climate. You know, it's like, objectively speaking, it was very, like, I don't think that any other country would have survived, you know, in this sanctions situation. But Russian economy managed to survive because of this technocratic, capable, competent leadership. So it's no longer, you know, like mafia-style economy. It was like that in the 90s for sure. But since then, the control over the economy was centralized. The so-called oligarchs, private businessmen, they were subordinated to the Kremlin. And there is a very elaborate system of, again, coordinating, steering the economy and coordinating private activity. And it might not be as elaborate as in China, but it's also very elaborate. And also Putin respects the market economy. So he has this idea that the market economy is very valuable because it's very flexible. And in fact, the mistake of the Soviet Union, so the mistake was not to have the Cold War with the West, because we're sort of destined to be in this Cold War with the West. But the mistake was to have the planned economy. So according to Putin, that was the main kind of mistake that the Soviet authorities made. Instead, the market economy is the best tool to confront the West, because you know, the market is always stronger than state planning. This is how Putin understands this. And so according to Putin, the market does not have value in its own right. So he's not some kind of libertarian, you know. But for him, the market is an instrument of national power. So you have this market economy, you have, you know, market freedoms even, but they are subordinated to national goals. That's how he understands the economy. And so I would say that all these ideas about technocracy and the market, they worked. They worked for the Kremlin, and they produced a very stable, very kind of flexible, resilient economic system. Again, it's like the downside is that the economy is not really growing. So there was some growth because of military production. And now they can no longer have the same amount of stimulus, and private industries are stagnating in Russia. But overall, this is, I would say, successful management in the conditions that Russia was put in 2022.
That's our show for today. I'd like to thank my guest, Ilya Matveyev. Thanks also to executive producer Robert Brenner, producer director Melissa Figueroa, and editor engineer Juliana Gota. And thank you to Gary Baca in Master Control. You can listen to this and other archive shows, as well as subscribe to the podcast at kpfk.org. Click Audio Archives and scroll down to Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. More information on programs and guests are on our Facebook page, Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. You've been listening to Beneath the Surface on KPFK Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond, streaming live and archived at kpfk.org. Thanks for listening and stay tuned. I'm Susie Wiseman.
I'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in, and especially thank those of you who pledged your support or renewed your membership to KPFK during this past fund drive. The support of generous listeners like you is what allows this listener-sponsored station to operate and to maintain its fierce independence. It's a very special relationship, so thank you once again for being a part of it.
Support comes from CAP UCLA, presenting Tiago Rodriguez by heart on Friday, October 24th and Saturday, October 25th at the Nimoy. Rodriguez, a Portuguese playwright and actor, invites 10 audience members onto the stage and teaches them a poem, an act inspired by his grandmother's journey to blindness. More info and tickets available at cap.ucla.edu and kpfk.org.
This is Stephanie Wells, Executive Director of Pacifica Foundation. Congress has defunded public media, threatening the survival of television and radio stations that provide trusted news, emergency alerts, and vital community connection. Years of corporate media consolidation and deregulation have taken media out of community hands, while social media platforms cut back on fact-checking, leaving communities vulnerable to misinformation. In this time of social crisis and climate emergencies, local stations provide vital information for keeping our community safe. You can help by supporting and donating to your local community media. This message comes to you in solidarity from the Pacifica Foundation.
Hi, this is Kurt Elling. You're listening to KPFK. 90-